So I've heard from Paula that these events usually lead to lively Q&A and a backlog of questions. So I'm going to try and keep my questions to the panel fairly brief, and I'll probably just ask one to start with to Glenn and Tracy. But Glenn, you're representing a company that's been around for a long time in Australia, over 130 years, as far as I'm aware. How do you interpret the results that I've presented tonight? And do you think this is evolution, or is this something, you know, is there a major shock that we've seen that's seen the attitudes shift to this extent?
Thank you, Jared, and thanks for your presentation too, and thanks for the invite to be here tonight. I think it's more than evolution to start with, and I also think I've got a foot in both camps. I think whilst I've been in financial services for my whole career, and I'm the sort of the financial services bunny on this panel, if you like, I've got a foot in both. I'm both a sort of an inflictor of the bad things that have happened over the 40 years that I've been about, but I'm also a consumer. So I've seen lots of good things happen and lots of bad things happen. I don't think it's evolution. I think it's, in our business at the moment, it's called a pattern interrupt. There is no doubt that we've had our private clients last year have been paralysed to make decisions. We've had a really ordinary year where people have been, their questions have been completely different to what they've been historically. And the thing that concerns me the most, I think, is the board members and the directors who represent not-for-profits and also directors of publicly listed companies. And I think that's one of the things that's a concern for us. Not-for-profit money doesn't do anything at 0.75%. And I think that's one of the concerns that I've got right now. How do we find a balance between the two? It's certainly not going to be easy, and it's not going to happen overnight either. And I certainly understand some of the terminology that Daniel's using around the trust deficit. We've got a whole program of work going on at the moment around trust is earned. For those of you who don't know, Perpetual's the oldest trust company in Australia, or one of the oldest trust companies, and it has been around for a long time. And we're quite different, if you like, to a financial services house that comes from, or was staged within a bank. And just the way we've dealt with people, it's always been fiduciary responsibility first and those sorts of things. But that hasn't suggested for one second that we haven't been infected or inflicted by this. Some of our compliance scenarios and whatnot now are not easily measured. You know, it's easy for us to measure numbers, and I can tell you some of the things around the conflicts in some of the, from the business owners or the business leaders to the humans, if you like us. I've one of the quotes from one of the senior directors in the Royal Commission was, he's never had anyone come up to him at an AGM and ask him for a better social license to operate, but he gets hounded every year about the lack of return or the poor return and so forth. So we've got a real disconnect in that space around, because I don't have many clients say to me, can I understand the social license to operate in the companies that form our portfolio? But I certainly have them asking why they've fallen in dividend returns. So I think that's another balance, if you like, and how do we measure some of those things? It's not easy to do. We can certainly measure 5% v 6%, but how can we measure something that's not quite so out there? So I think that's probably a half an answer.
So clearly there's a role for the education sector here, and perhaps business schools. So Tracy, how do business schools adapt to the changing environment in terms of the skills that the current and future business leaders need to have, and how can they contribute to making well-formed individuals who take up these roles given the growing expectations?
And that's certainly a challenge that business schools have faced, particularly over the last 20 or so years. Some of you may be familiar with, in 2005, Warren Bennis and James O'Toole wrote a seminal article published in the Harvard Business Review called How Business Schools Lost Their Way. And that was basically saying that business schools got so caught up in the rankings game and in producing research that got published in good quality journals that they forgot about the purpose of creating students and creating a learning environment whereby we were able to produce graduates who were going out and were able to have boundary crossing skills that addressed a number of these challenges that have been highlighted both by Daniel and yourself, Jared. And in those ensuing years, since 2005, what we've seen is business schools now trying to become more multidisciplinary in their approaches, not just teaching in silos, like here is economics, here is accounting, marketing, etc., but creating opportunities for learning that connect with real-life problems and provide students with opportunities, not just in class, but in terms of working with businesses in problem-solving, skill development, in looking at applying different techniques such as design thinking to decision making and coming up with curriculums that are much more inclusive of engaging with the business community in their education. I think we've got a responsibility as thought leaders, as universities, as both Jared and Daniel and David have mentioned, to not just respond to business or community expectations, but to lead the way, to provide education and learning opportunities for our students that engage with our business leaders and our community leaders, bring them into the classroom to work together, to co-create solutions to a number of these problems that have been identified, particularly around that social and environmental agenda, as well as the economic one that so clearly came out in the company Pulse report. You know, it's clear that both business leaders and the public have equally weighted those areas, and we should be equally addressing them within the ways in which we deliver our education and learning.
All right, so we've heard from an economist, a communicator, an educator, and a business person. So that's a pretty good sweep of perspectives. We'll go to questions from the floor.
Renee Rutherford from Rio Tinto. Quite curious to know if there'll be a government pulse to follow. I think, and it probably might be one for Daniel to comment on, but the Edelman Trust Barometer, there's a global trend that people generally trust companies over government. And at least through the research that Rio Tinto we do with CSIRO, with Local Voices, that's replicated in WA as well, that there's a lot of more trust in us as a business. But a lot of the things that where community would like to see the dial shift, we can't and shouldn't do alone as a company on our own. We need to partner or work with government. So I'm not sure if there's a silver bullet or just interested in some thoughts around government's role in how we can also then increase the trust in the system, so to speak.
A couple of things there. Well, we'll see to do a government pulse. I think CETA should. I think it'll be a very interesting conversation. And I think it'd be very good to compare trust relativities between government and large corporations, but also large corporations with small corporations, small businesses and the like. Because I noted in this year's company pulse, one of the priorities that was identified for profitable companies by the community was the paying of small businesses on time, for example. And it's important, and I should have mentioned this in my presentation, that when we talk about industry, people don't see large companies and small businesses as the same. They're very different. And the sort of people I'm talking about actually see small businesses as the victims as well. And so it's an important distinction to make. Look, I think government and industry needs to work together. I don't think government or industry, large companies, can do this alone. I don't think, you know, is that entwined in people's minds? People don't distinguish, in my experience, broadly speaking, between the actions of government and industry at that level. They are thinking about outcomes in their lives. They focus on what is happening around them. and they're thinking about the system itself as not delivering for them. I think when you get into very specific questioning of people and you ask people to choose between one or the other, then you're going to get scores like that. But as people go around their day-to-day lives, they're not cursing companies. You know what I mean? They are worried about the system and how it's impacting upon them. And I think you could do endless research into this, but at the end of the day, you'd probably come to the conclusion that government and industry need to work together to address a lot of these issues.
Just on the government pulse point, not wanting to add to my work program, but certainly next year we will do community pulse again, and there is kind of a third part of that survey that goes to a key topic. So it's certainly something that I would think about. Also, the OECD has some interesting work on this. They do a Risks That Matter survey across, I think it's 20 countries, 19,000 people, and they find that a lot of people feel disenfranchised with the policy process. They don't feel that policy processes and the policies that governments ultimately come up with involve them or their views to a great extent. So, but I agree with the point about different sectors needing to work together as well. Question down here.
Hi, I'm Alana Joski from Westport. We're a government task force planning for the freight future of Perth, long-term freight future, 50 years and ahead. Daniel knows our project well. We have been saying, so where our project's at, we're getting a lot of feedback from the community, and we're sort of saying that instead of the NIMBY, which is not in my backyard, it's now people are now becoming bananas, which means build absolutely nothing anywhere near anything. And because anytime you build anything, you're going to have some sort of impact, and people aren't going to tolerate impacts. So we're sort of in this situation where we feel like the community's expectations are so high, it's almost impossible to meet them. And I feel like the disconnect in what the business leaders and the community have said in the report, you know, people are focused on their short-term outcomes, but business is focused on long-term planning. And you can't have short-term success without the long-term planning. So I just sort of feel like it's an unwinnable situation. Not really sure that's a question, but feel free to make a comment.
Can I have a word on that? Thanks. Interesting on the short-term, because in financial services, we're measured on everything short-term. So you've got to measure 1, 3, and 5 year outcomes or numbers, and that's what you've got to report to the market. So how do you put together something that says, let's have a 1, 3, and 5 year strategy to change the world, not the world, but you know, to change things up? I think relativities for me in this part is, as a result of the Royal Commission, one of the things that Haynes suggested to us was that we should, our scorecards, whatever you want to call them, needed to have their financial weightings brought right back. And because historically, as long as I've been in the thing, it was the measurement was, it didn't matter how much percentage allocation was to financials. If you didn't get financials, you got nothing. Okay, so you might have, you know, NPS and all of these other measurements, compliance and operations and whatever measured and how you deal with people and all of that. You'd have all that stuff, but really if you missed financials, you missed. So we've now got to somehow turn that around, take percentages off the thing, or certainly don't have them weighted to more than 25. But then how do we reward people? Because last time I checked, the only way you reward people is financially in some shape or form. So we've got the problem, but no answer. You know, so these are the sorts of things where getting the balance right. What is the balance? And I think you're exactly right. I mean, well, we made a comment just when we were talking before this started. There was a CEO, I'm pretty sure it was SEEK. We agreed it was the SEEK CEO this year. He said, there's no dividend because we need the money more than you do, because there's opportunities in the marketplace that are just far better than us giving back the money to you. And his share price went up 8% that day. I mean, go figure. So, yeah, it's certainly a challenge, isn't it? And I like the banana thing. Is that a marketing thing? Yeah, it's good, isn't it? Yeah, nice.
Look, I'll just make a couple of comments on that as well. This is something we talk about in our office every day, are the challenges of getting significant projects through the community at this point. And there's two trends or two realities that I think we're grappling with any number of projects. and that is increased population density in the areas that we want to do development, and two, the ability of people to organise at the local level on social media and drag in people from all over the place. So the ability of people to organise against projects. There are plenty of examples in WA over the last few years of projects just going splat. You know, otherwise good projects. We've got one in Mandurah now. I'm just getting to understand that one. There's the Wave Park. There's Row 8. The towers in Scarborough. Any number of projects that possibly could have gone ahead, you've much more effort had gone into in an early stage in terms of community engagement, finding out what's important to the community and responding to that in a genuine way. I think Westport, the work you're doing now around engagement, will stand the project good in the test of time, even though it's difficult now, because there's plenty of projects that aren't doing the work that you're doing right now.
Got a question up
here. Good evening. Clinton Byrne from Bupa Health Insurance. I think it's staring us in the face. The top five issues, three of them are linked to wellness, work-life balance, and training and career prospects. It's all linked to staff, isn't it? And is the balance of investment that corporates put into all the objectives they have, and Bupa's like this, we invest in Indigenous issues, we invest in environmental issues, we invest in mental health and wellbeing, but are we getting the investment right about investing in our people if they're three of the top five things? So I'd just like, that's more of a statement, but I'm open to further discussion about it.
Can I just come at that from a little different angle? So in my previous institution, we did a study of all of our 18 to 24-year-old students over a three-year period, and over 40% said that they wanted, when they graduated, to work for a startup or found their own company. Now, that same study, when it was done 10 years ago, would have had about 5%. And a lot of that is driven by particularly a younger generation wanting a different way of working. And if they can't see it as a viable alternative in large corporations or even medium-sized ones, then they want to create those businesses and products and work environments themselves for their own future and for the future of the people that they're going to be working with. So it's I think a change in mindset that we're experiencing at the moment.
Just a little bit more to that too. I think you're absolutely right. So I worked at Perpetual 20 something years ago and came back 10 years ago. So I wrote this down before. These things are culturally ingrained in the business as much as you can do. But diversity, flexibility, domestic violence policy, reconciliation action plan and gender diversity, none of those things were present 10 years ago. The CEO that started 10 years ago brought all of those things into the business. So a 130-year-old company, none of that was even a consideration at board and exco level.
We've got a question up here.
Sue Ash. When I was looking at the disconnect between the drivers for business and drivers for the general population, my background in social sciences and human services screamed at me that said, from a business point of view, the issues for the general public wanting, you know, wages, business paid on time, etc., that general economic anxiety just jumped out of that page for me and told me two things. One was, no wonder people are feeling like they can't trust the outcomes because they actually don't feel cared for. Because the other side of that was all about long term, not about the day-to-day struggle of trying to live when you just don't have enough cash. And secondly, it also said to me that we are vulnerable to continue to look at only seeing people's worth through a dollar figure. So my question is, particularly to educators, but also to business and how we communicate this, how do we actually shift that around so that we are speaking to everybody in the community in a way that demonstrates a value, which is important to me, that everyone's worthwhile, and that we actually do care about those people who aren't on the rung.
Who wants to start?
Oh, look, so I couldn't agree more, and that was the central thrust of my presentation, I guess. Look, that disconnect exists, and the expectations of the community are significantly different from the expectations of the drivers for industry. But we all know the responsibilities company directors have to make decisions and maximise profits and maximise shareholder value. We know that. So there's a bigger question to be had around those responsibilities and those requirements by law. I think, as I talked to at the end of my presentation, industry has, when I say industry, it's a broad brush, but that there is a conversation, or industry needs to be thinking very carefully about where we head over the next 10 to 20 years, because who knows what the future of work will bring, but if we end up in an environment where fewer and fewer people have a stake, an economic stake, in the success of a business, for example, a social media company, you know, very few people have an economic stake in the success of Facebook, for example, right now. And if other companies become like that, then the disconnect between companies and people becomes greater. And I would think that would come at great risk to companies. Because if people perceive companies as not delivering economically for them, and there's a large enough group of those people, that in a democracy, they can have their say. And we're likely to see all sorts of interesting political outcomes and policy responses as a result. So my message to industry generally is consider this and factor that into your risk assessment.
And if I can add, I think one of the other components to this, is if we look at the recently released CEO salaries, and you look at the top 50 CEO salaries in Australia. Take Alan Joyce, who was reported as having 23.9 million salary in 2018, which was, I think, 275 times that of the average worker. And then you talk about, you know, that discrepancy and how do you build or regain trust through actions within a business if you're continuing to support a widening wage gap and marginalization of the people that that you've identified that are seeing themselves as increasingly challenged just to make ends meet.
I think this is the final wow. question to David.
I feel bad that I'm getting the last question. I'm tempted to throw a bit of a hand grenade in here, which is probably unfair for the last question, but it makes me, I will, don't worry. It makes me think that are we, my questions to Jared, I guess, is are we actually dealing with a trust issue, or is it more around, and building on Sue's question, which I thought was absolutely spot on, around people being left behind? So it was around wages, cost of living pressures, you know, job security, those issues, which is then manifesting into uncertainty, insecurity, etc. So I'm just wondering, Jared, are we dealing with a trust issue, or is it a left behind society issue?
I think it's impossible to separate the two. So I think you're absolutely right. I think the material circumstances for a lot of people are driving distrust. When you don't feel like you are getting ahead, but others are, that immediately drives distrust. When you feel like you should be getting a wage rise, even if there are strong economic reasons why that's not the case, you begin to build distrust. So I do think that the economic factors come into play very strongly here, and particularly in Australia, because we had such a long period in which incomes were going up, most people's lives were getting better, and then we've had this flat period in terms of national income for almost a decade now, and I think that does build that kind of, you know, underlying tension and distrust.
Yeah, one more comment. Just going back to the political examples I gave earlier and thinking to the federal election, all over the country, every capital city looked the same in terms of which areas swung to the Labor Party and which areas swung to the Coalition. And effectively, it was inner city established suburbs with people with high incomes, university degrees that swung to the Labor Party, and people in the outer suburbs and regions with TAFE qualifications and having just completed high school and on low incomes that swung to the Liberal Party, which was counterintuitive for a lot of people. But a lot of the research we did and others did around that time pointed to people having, there's sort of two groups within the community, and that is people with material drivers and people with non-material drivers. And so if you earn enough to, and this is very generalising, there's lots of individual differences, but if you can afford to declare about climate change as a vote changer, as the driver of your vote, then you do. If you're similarly, you might care about marriage equality, or you might worry about the treatment of refugees. But if you're having trouble keeping food on the table and you're worried about where your next job's coming from, or you're looking for more hours, then you're worried about much more material things and you vote accordingly. And that's the sort of thing we saw at that election, we saw it at the previous state election here, we've seen it at elections all over the Western world in the last few years. So there is that divide opening up, and I think, you know, I worry for society if it widens further.
Okay. On behalf of everybody here, I would like to thank our speakers tonight. I think we leave with more questions than we arrived in. I think there's quite a somber message, but I think there's also a hopeful message because Daniel's kind of view of some things that we can all think about and then even going to Clint's question from Bupa and Sue Ash's question, reminding us again that it's all about the humanness of things. And I think that was fascinating with this report, where the humanness of all the answers came out and the similarities, but also the differences. So the system, trusting in the system, or is the system broken? Like, I think, and the hope for this system that we all live in. And quoting Alana, giving us all a new acronym, I think we're going to be needing that definition again before we think of bananas. To Jared for joining us tonight and for sharing his wisdom. I especially loved the slide that showed, you know, the history, and that CEDA next year is going to be 60 years old, and we're kind of coming with old and new ideas and looking backwards and looking forwards. So thank you for reminding us of that. And Daniel, for joining us, really the detailed research you did, and actually doing some research specifically for this event was really much appreciated. And to Tracy, day two. Whew, that's a KPI. Thank you for joining, Dick. She did a fantastic job, David. And Glenn, you know, you really added enormous value with your perspectives, with your long career, but also the financial sector, which is at the coalface of a lot of criticism, but also change at the moment. And to David and the team at Murdoch University, thank you so much for hosting us tonight. And to everybody for joining us. There's lots more questions. There's some drinks upstairs and some networking and some food as well. So please stay and enjoy that. And thank you again for joining us. Good evening.